This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was 15 years ago that the U.S. pulled out of Saigon. Vietnam was called the First Television War, and many of the war's supporters and critics believed that watching the violence on the news every night after dinner helped turn Americans against the war. My guest, Morley Safer, was one of the first reporters to bring the war home on TV. He opened up the CBS Saigon Bureau in 1965 and reported from Vietnam off and on until 1971. After his early reports, Fred Friendly, then the head of CBS News, nicknamed Vietnam Morley Safer's War. Safer is now in his 20th year as a correspondent for 60 Minutes. Last year, he returned to Vietnam for a 60 Minutes story. In a new book, Flashbacks, he writes both about his return to Vietnam and about his years there as a correspondent. One of Safer's first Vietnam reports was also his most controversial. He accompanied Marines on a search-and-destroy mission to Cam Ne. The Marines burned the hamlet down. This is an excerpt of Safer's 1965 report.
If there were Viet Cong in the hamlets, they were long gone, alerted by the roar of the amphibious tractors and the heavy barrage of rocket fire laid down before the troops moved in. The women and the old men who remained will never forget that August afternoon. Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature. There's little doubt that American firepower can win a military victory here. But to a Vietnamese peasant whose home is means a lifetime of backbreaking labor, it will take more than presidential promises to convince him that we are on his side.
Can you describe what the mission was?
The mission was not an extraordinary one. I had been up in Da Nang, which was the where the headquarters of the Marines were. The Marines were responsible in Vietnam for something called I Corps. It's the military way of saying First Corps. And I had arrived back up in Da Nang. I used to go up there every couple of weeks and went out from the press center and checked in with various battalions to find out whether they had operations going on. And this one group said they had an operation going on the next morning. Would I like to come? And I said, yes, I would. And the cameraman, Hat Thuc Khan, and I, and a young man named Tien, who was a sound man, arrived at, 5:30, 6 in the morning. And off we went in some amphibious tracked vehicles. And along the way, a young officer told me they were going to, in effect, burn out a group of hamlets called Cam Ne. And I said, why? And he said, because the head honcho, the head Vietnamese honcho, who was, I guess, would have been the district chief, had ordered it. And I found this hard to believe because as brutal as search and destroy operations often were, at least in theory, they were not designed to level a place. I mean, if you received fire, if there was fighting, that might have been the inevitable result. But we moved into this village. They laid down a full array of what they call prepping it, rockets, some artillery, and very heavy small arms fire, with very little return fire seemed to be coming out of the place. And then the Marines moved in and proceeded to burn the village down with everything from flamethrowers to cigarette lighters.
So there you were in the middle of American troops torching these hamlets. You had to decide what you were going to shoot, where you were going to direct the camera. Did you direct the camera, or was that his decisions about what to actually...
No, it's a mutual effort, but in those days, things have gotten more sophisticated now. You were tethered to the cameraman and the sound man, so you were...
Oh, because you had your microphone attached into his camera.
That's right, so you're three people walking as one. I directed it. You direct the camera to where the action is, and it's... You don't have to have many years of experience in journalism to know to do that. And we directed the camera in the obvious places. And what was becoming increasingly obvious as we walked through the village is that there was no enemy there. If he'd been there, he'd been long gone. They must have heard us coming from miles away. As reckless as the Viet Cong often were, or brave, or whatever you want to call them, they weren't about to take on an armored force like that. So if they were there, they were gone. And this wasn't an atrocity. You can't make any comparison with anything that happened in Germany or something like My Lai. This is quite a different kind of thing. But nevertheless, people were in shock to have seen on their television screens this kind of action by their boys.
Well, sure, you saw the soldiers torching the huts. You saw Vietnamese peasants
pleading.
Cowering in fight. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, cowering in fright and pleading, weeping, and looking very helpless.
It was an awful afternoon. Awful afternoons like that happened all over the country for all kinds of reasons. From other American units, very often from the atrocities that the Viet Cong committed when they came through a village, even a village that was neutral or even well disposed to them. I mean, those are the things that happen in war, cliché to say. I don't think Americans were prepared to see or accept young Americans doing those things.
Morley Safer is my guest, and he's written a new book called Flashbacks on Returning to Vietnam. You said before that it was, you know, just really obvious when you were deciding what to shoot. But I'll bet in a lot of ways it wasn't really obvious at all, because there are some things that you knew they'd never show on television.
I don't know about that. You know, first of all, you report, you show whatever you can show. You have editors to make those tricky decisions. That may not happen quite so much anymore because of live television. I hate to think what covering that war would have been like, quite honestly, had it happened in the 90s. Just imagine. First of all, we would be covering it live. Quite simple technology now. Without the chance by either the reporter or the editor or the producer in New York to be in any way reflective. I'm not a great advocate of live television. I think it's extremely dangerous in one respect and often misleading, because if I had been out in the field on that and forced to speak and think as things happened, who knows what I would have said? I have no idea. I might have done some jingoistic, you know, our brave boys attacking this fortified hamlet, because I just wouldn't know enough at that point.
Lyndon Johnson, who was the president at the time, tried to get CBS to fire you. And you said Bill Moyers was helping Johnson. He was working for Johnson at the time. Moyers was helping Johnson try to discredit you. In what way was he doing that?
Well, he was privy to, at one point, the White House claimed that it had a file on me that would suggest that I was, at the very least, a communist sympathizer, up to even being a KGB agent, and that unless CBS got rid of me, they would go public with this information, which was pure bluff. And if an investigation was made of me in Canada, where I came from, which I suspect they probably did, they would have found that the Safers are an extremely conservative family. With absolutely, it was just stupid. Moyers knew about this, nevertheless helped to propagate it, and if not, sat idly by, which I find slightly ironic, given the his place in the pantheon of liberal saints. He also very angrily asked a colleague of mine, what on earth is CBS doing hiring foreigners?
You were Canadian.
Canadian. And he wanted to know why we had a Vietnamese cameraman working for us.
You worked with Moyers later as colleagues. How did this affect your working relationship?
I've always felt a little bit uneasy in Bill's company, quite honestly. And I've talked to him about this twice. I asked him about it twice. And each time he laughed it off as that he really was playing a kind of a mollifier to the rages of... He was trying to mollify the president, trying to keep him cool during his rages over the coverage of Vietnam. I know that's not true. In any case, Bill and I have never worked together very closely. We occupy the same building for a while.
How did it affect you in the field when you started doing reports that were showing things that were kind of going wrong in Vietnam, showing American soldiers torching hamlets? Did the military work against you in any way, and did you rely on the military either for information but also for other assistance?
We were totally we totally relied on the military for transport to within the country. I mean, there was some commercial traffic, but very little. And you had to go by military transport, by helicopter, by transport plane. We relied 90% on the military to get around. We relied on the military often for facilities to get information back to Saigon from the field. So in that respect, they were very, very cooperative. Later on, as time went on, they became less and less cooperative and would often actively work to thwart you. The Marine Corps made life very miserable for me after that broadcast that you spoke of.
How?
Oh, well, they started out with threats. If there were a group of correspondents trying to get to a particular battle... they saw to it that I was last in, and they made an attempt to see that I was last out. We got around that. But what was interesting is as the war ground on, as things got worse, as the American presence increased from 30,000 to 50 to 100 to 500,000 men, the military became less and less cooperative, but the civilian side remained very cooperative, very interesting. The intelligence community remained very cooperative. I think there was a genuine effort, and I don't know if it was conscious at the time, but the net effect is that this thing, this aberrant behavior by the United States, so far from home, should be properly recorded.
You know, you were talking about how the military started to work against you after your reports were started to be broadcast from Vietnam. After your report from Cam Nay, you laid awake all night with a gun, a loaded gun. What were you afraid of? What were you expecting?
Well, after sending that piece in, we left Da Nang, went back to Saigon, and the following day... You must remember, Terry, I was younger. The following day, I got a call from the Marines in Da Nang saying if I ever showed my face there again, they would not be responsible for what happened to me. And I said, well, you've never been responsible for what happens to me. What do you mean by that? Is this a threat? We just want to tell you, show your face around here and something's going to happen. So I went to Hatukan and I said, listen, I'm not going to tell you got to come up back up there, but I'm going up. Do you want to come? See this thing through. So Khan and I went back to...
This is your cameraman.
Yeah, back to Da Nang, and we had a little... The Marines ran something called a press center. It was like a motel there. And each of the networks and a couple of the papers had permanent rooms there. And I went... It's the only time I carried a gun. And I went into the sort of bar, dining room... And had my dinner alone with Hatukan. Nobody would join us. except for an Air Force officer who hated the Marines because he was in the Air Force. And at about 8 or 9 o'clock, I got up, and there were a lot of cracks coming from the bar and pretty rough stuff. And I pointed to my bag. I said, there's a gun in here. Anybody can comes through that door, I'm just going to blow them away. I'm not going to ask any questions. You know, tough guy. I've seen too many movies or something. And I was scared stiff. And Con and I went back and we got into our bunks. And I locked the door and I sat there trying to, lay in bed trying to read. And I had this pistol on the night table and I had the safety on and then I had the safety off. And then I better leave the safety on because I'm liable to roll over in the middle of the night and shoot my foot off or something. So I put the safety on, and I lay awake all night, scared as hell that somebody might actually come through the door. And I knew I wouldn't do anything. I just don't think I could fire a pistol at someone, or at something for that matter. Anyway, it was tempers cooled, to put it that way. And my relationship with the Marine Corps now is very good.
Morley Safer is my guest, and he's written a new book called Flashbacks on Returning to Vietnam. One of the people who you met on your return to Vietnam that you knew when you were reporting in Vietnam was a Vietnamese Time correspondent who, it was rumored, was really a CIA spy, but as it turned out, he was really a spy for the North Vietnamese. When did you find out about that?
Well, there was a lot of curiosity about Pham Xuan An after the war, when he did not come out.
He didn't come out of Saigon.
When he didn't come out, because Time and CBS, Newsweek, everybody else arranged in the chaos that led up to the fall of Saigon for those Vietnamese who wanted to come out, and virtually all the Vietnamese staffs of American news organizations wanted out because they reckoned, and I think quite accurately so, that they would be marked men and women. An got his family out on the Time plane, but he stayed himself. So that obviously raised an awful lot of curiosity about who this guy really was. So there was a lot of suspicion at that point that he probably was working for the National Liberation Front. He led a double life, but the job that his masters wanted him to do was exactly the same job as his masters at Time Magazine wanted. They wanted intelligence on the war, particularly in the on what the Vietnamese military was up to, on strengths, on the corruptibility of various officers, on the who was doing what to whom politically, and Vietnamese politics was just Byzantium times 10. And An, in his wonderful way, managed to pick his way through all that and was a great help to not just people at Time magazine, because he's a very generous man. He would fill everybody in who wanted to be filled in on Vietnamese politics.
Still, did you feel betrayed finding out that he was really a spy?
No, I don't feel any betrayal. Who did he betray? Who did he betray? He remained true to his nation. He is a nationalist. He is the essence of Pham Xuan An. Is, I think, in the something he told me, and he said, "All I wanted for Vietnam were the things Americans already had."
Did your return to Vietnam help clarify for you any of your thoughts about either America's involvement there or our lasting effects on the country or what your period in Vietnam meant in your life? I mean, I guess I'm wondering if there was one, like, really big, oh, now I see, that you were left with.
Really all of the above, because it clarified in writing the book. I cannot tell you the exhilaration for a reporter who always has the fetters of objectivity and house rules and everything else to be able to write what I think, you know, period. Without having to say, according to certain sources, according to me is really what the writing a book is about. And that was a wonderful, liberating experience. I'm now, you know, creeping back into my shell because I got to get on with the real world. So that was liberating and clarifying because I was able to distill one's thoughts on this war. And while I think the book is full of contradictions, and I certainly hope it is because it then truly represents the nature of that place. No one comes away clean from Vietnam, but going back somehow does have a cleansing effect.
Well, I hope at some point in the future we have a chance to talk about your work over the past 20 years on 60 Minutes. That will have to wait for another interview. Thank you very much for talking with us about Vietnam.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Morley Safer, and his new book is called Flashbacks on Returning to Vietnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.